in front of every freelance journalist looking for a story. Butterworth mumbled an apology as they stepped into the elevator, and Cavalli pressed button 11. Neither of them spoke again until they were safely inside 1137, the room in which Cavalli had spent the previous night. Cavalli looked more carefully at Rex Butterworth now that they were alone. He was sweating as if he had just finished a 5-mile jog, not traveled up 11 floors, in an elevator. "Calm down," said Cavalli. "You've played your part well so far. Only one more phone call and you're through. You'll be on a flight to Rio before the first outrider even reaches the National Archives. Now, are you clear about what you have to say to Marshall?" Butterworth took out some handwritten notes, mouthed a few words, and said, "Yes, I'm clear, and I'm ready." He was shaking like jelly. Cavalli dialed the private number of the archivist's office half a mile away, and when he heard the first ring, passed the receiver over to Butterworth. They both listened to the continuing ringing. Eventually, Cavalli put his hand out to take back the receiver. They would have to try again in a few minutes' time. Suddenly there was a click, and a voice said, "Calder Marshall speaking." Cavalli went into the bathroom and picked up the extension. "Good morning, Mr. Marshall. It's Rex Butterworth at the White House, just checking everything's all set up and ready at your end." "It certainly is, Mr. Butterworth. Every member of my staff has been instructed to be at his desk by 9 o'clock sharp. In fact, I've seen most of them already, but only my deputy and the senior conservator know the real reason I've asked them all not to be late this morning." "Well done," said Butterworth. "The president is running on time, and we anticipate he will be with you around 10, but I'm afraid he still has to be back at the White House by 11.
"By 11, of course," said the archivist.
"I only hope we can get him around the whole building in 50 minutes, because I feel certain there are many of my staff who would like to meet him." "We'll just have to hope that 50 minutes is enough time to fit them all in," said Butterworth. "Can I assume that there are still no problems with the president's personal request?"
"None that I'm aware of," said Marshall.
"The conservator is quite happy to remove the glass so that the president can study the parchment in its original form. We'll keep the declaration in the vault until the president has left the building. I hope to have the document back on view to the general public a few minutes after he departs."
"It sounds to me as if you have everything under control, Mr. Marshall," said Butterworth, the sweat pouring off his forehead. "I'm just off to see the president, so I'm afraid I'll be out of contact for the rest of the morning. But let's talk again this afternoon, and you can tell me how it all went."
Cavalli placed the phone on the side of the bath and bolted back into the bedroom, coming to a halt in front of the president's special assistant. Butterworth looked terrified. Cavalli shook his head frantically from side to side.
"Actually, now that I look at my schedule, Mr. Marshall, I see you won't be able to reach me again today because I promised my wife I'd leave the office a little earlier than usual to prepare for our annual vacation, which begins tomorrow."
"Oh, where are you going?" asked Marshall innocently.
"Off to see my mother in Charleston. But I feel confident that the president's visit to the archives will be a great success. Why don't we get together as soon as I'm back?"
"I would enjoy that," said Marshall. "And I do hope you have a pleasant break in South Carolina. The azaleas should still be blooming."
"Yes, I suppose they will," said Butterworth as he watched Cavalli pulling a finger across his throat. "My other line is ringing," he added, and without another word put the phone down.
"You said too much, you fool. We don't ever want him trying to contact you again."
Butterworth looked apprehensive.
"How long will it be before the White House wonders where you are?" asked Cavalli.
"At least a week," replied Butterworth.
"I really am due for my vacation, and even my boss thinks I'm going to Charleston."
"Well, that's something you did right," said Cavalli, as he handed Butterworth a one-way ticket to Rio de Janeiro and a letter of confirmation that the sum of $900,000 had been deposited in the Banco do Brasil.
"I have to get back to the set," said Cavalli. "You stay put for 10 minutes and then take a taxi to Dulles Airport. And when you get to Brazil, don't spend all the money on a girl. And Rex, don't even think about coming back. If you do, it won't just be the feds who are waiting for you at the airport."
Angelo had somehow managed to get Dollar Bill dressed, but he still stank of Guinness, and he certainly didn't look like the president's personal physician, or anybody else's physician, for that matter.
Sorry, lad, Dollar Bill kept repeating. I hope this won't get you into any trouble.
It will if you don't sober up in time to play your part and see that the parchment is transferred into the special cylinder. Because if Cavalli ever finds out I wasn't with you last night, you're dead, and more important, so am I.
Settle down, lad, and just make me a Bloody Mary. 2 parts tomato juice and 1 part vodka. I'll be as right as rain in no time, you'll see.
Angelo looked doubtful as the little man's head fell back on the pillow. As Cavalli closed the door of room 1137, a woman pushing a large laundry basket passed him in the corridor. He took the elevator to the ground floor and walked straight out of the hotel. The first thing he saw as he left the Willard and crossed the plaza that divided the hotel from Pennsylvania Avenue was that the morning traffic was backed up for half a mile down 15th Street. Al and Johnny came running towards him from different directions. "What's going on?" were Cavalli's first words.
"Normal morning traffic coming in from Virginia, the police assure us, except we're blocking a lane and a half with our 12 vehicles and 6 outriders."
"Damn, my mistake," said Cavalli. "I should have anticipated it. So what do you suggest, Al?"
"I send my boys over to Atlantic Garage on 13th and F until the police get the traffic on the move again, and then bring them back nearer the starting time."
"It's a hell of a risk," said Johnny. "That permit only allows me to film for 45 minutes, and they aren't going to stretch it by a second."
"But if my cars stay put, you might never get started at all," said Al.
"Okay, Al, you get moving, but make sure you're back on the grid by 9:50. Cavalli checked his watch. "That's 27 minutes. Al began running towards the parked cars. Cavalli turned his attention to the director. "What time are you bringing the actor out?"
9:55, or the moment the last car is back in place. He's being made up in that trailer over there," said Johnny, pointing.
Cavalli watched as the 6th limousine pulled away and was relieved to see the traffic start to flow again.
"And Gino's Secret Service agents, what'll happen to them now that the cars have gone?" "Most of them are hanging around with the extras, but they aren't looking too convincing."
Cavalli's cellular phone began to ring. "I have to get back or you won't have a film, real or otherwise," said Johnny. Cavalli nodded and said, "Yes," into the mouthpiece as the director rushed away. Something caught Cavalli's eye as he tried to concentrate on the voice on the other end of the line.
"The helicopter's all set to take off at 10 o'clock sharp, boss, but it loses its slot at 7 minutes past. The traffic cops won't let it go up after that, however much you gave to the Fraternal Order of Police."
"We're still running on schedule despite some problems," said Cavalli, "so take her up at 10 and just hover over the route. Marshall and his staff must be able to see and hear you when we arrive at the archives. That's all I care about."
"Okay, boss, understood."
Cavalli checked his watch again. It was 9:36, and the traffic was now flowing smoothly. He walked over to the officer coordinating the shoot for the city's motion picture and television office.
"Don't worry," said the lieutenant, even before Cavalli had opened his mouth. "The traffic will be stopped and the detour signs in place by 9:59. We'll have you moving on time, I promise."
"Thank you, officer," said Cavalli, and quickly dialed Al Calabrese. "I think you'd better start getting your boys back.
Number one has already left with 2 outriders. Number 2's just about to go. After that, they leave at 20-second intervals."
"You should have been an army general," said Cavalli.
"You can blame the government for that. I just didn't get the right education."
Suddenly, Pennsylvania Avenue was ablaze with lights. Cavalli, like everyone else, shielded his eyes, and then, just as suddenly, the lights were switched off, making the morning sun appear like a dim light bulb.
"Good sparks," Cavalli heard the director shout. "I could only spot one that didn't function, the 7th on the right."
Cavalli stood on the sidewalk and looked towards the corner of 13th Street. He could see the first of Al's limousines with 2 outriders edging its way back through the traffic. The sight of the shining black limo made him feel nervous for the first time. A tall, well-built, bald man wearing dark glasses, a dark blue suit, white shirt, and a red, white, and blue striped tie was walking towards him. He stopped by Cavalli's side as the first of the 2 outriders in the leading police car drew into the curb.
"How are you feeling?" asked Cavalli.
"Like all first nights," said Lloyd Adams. "I'll be just fine once the curtain goes up."
"Well, you sure knew your lines word perfect last night."
"My lines aren't the problem," said Adams. "It's Marshall's I'm worried about."
"What do you mean?" asked Cavalli.
"He's not been able to attend any of our rehearsals, has he?" replied the actor. "So he doesn't know his cues."
The second car drew into line, accompanied by two more outriders, as Al came running across the sidewalk and Lloyd Adams strode off in the direction of the trailer.
"Can you still do it in 11 minutes? Asked Cavalli, looking at his watch.
"As long as Chief Thomas's finest don't foul things up like they do every other morning," said Al.
He headed towards the cars and immediately began to organize the unfurling of the presidential flag on the front of the third car before checking on any specks of dirt that might have appeared on the bodywork after one trip around the block. The staff van drew up in line. Scaziatori immediately swung around on his high stool and, through a megaphone, told the actor, the secretary, the lieutenant, and the physician to be ready to climb into the third and fourth cars. When the director asked for the lieutenant and the physician, Cavalli suddenly realized that he hadn't seen Dollar Bill or Angelo all morning. Perhaps they'd been waiting in the trailer. The fourth limousine drew up as Cavalli's eyes swept the horizon, searching for Angelo. The klaxon sounded again for several seconds, this time to warn the film crew that they had 10 minutes left before shooting. The noise almost prevented Cavalli from hearing his phone ringing.
"It's Andy reporting in, boss. I'm still outside the National Archives. Just to let you know, it's no busier than when you checked up an hour ago."
"At least someone's awake," said Cavalli.
"There can't be more than 20 or 30 people around at the moment."
"Glad to hear it, but don't call me again unless something goes wrong."
Cavalli flicked off the phone and tried to remember what it was that had been worrying him before it rang. 11 vehicles and 6 outriders were now in place. One vehicle was still missing. But something else was nagging at the back of Cavalli's mind. He became distracted when an officer standing in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue began shouting at the top of his voice that he was ready to stop the traffic whenever the director gave the word. Johnny stood up on his chair and pointed frantically to the 12th car, which remained obstinately stuck in traffic a couple of 100 yards away.
"If you divert the traffic now," shouted Johnny, "that one's never going to end up in the motorcade."
The officer remained in the middle of the road and waved the traffic through as fast as he could in the hope of getting a limousine there quicker. But it didn't make a lot of difference.
"Extras on the street!" shouted Johnny,
and several people whom Cavalli had supposed were members of the public strolled onto the sidewalk and began walking up and down professionally. Johnny stood up on his chair again and this time turned to face the crowd huddled behind the barriers. An aide handed him a megaphone so that he could address them.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he began, "this is a short cut for a movie about the president going to the Hill to address a joint session of Congress. I'd be grateful if you could wave, clap, and cheer as if it were the real president. Thank you."
Spontaneous applause broke out, which made Cavalli laugh for the first time that morning. He hadn't noticed that the former deputy police chief had crept up behind him during the director's address. He whispered in his ear,
"This is going to cost you a whole lot of money if you don't pull it off the first time."
Cavalli turned to face the ex-policeman and tried not to show how anxious he felt.
"The holdup, I mean. If you don't get the shoot done this morning, the authorities aren't going to let you go through this charade again for one hell of a time."
"I don't need to be reminded of that," snapped Cavalli. He turned his attention back to Johnny, who had climbed down from his chair and was walking over to take his seat on the tracking dolly, ready to move as soon as the 12th vehicle was in place. Once again, the aide passed Johnny the megaphone.
"This is a final check. Check your positions, please. This is a final check. Everyone ready in car one?"
There was a sharp honk in reply.
"Car two?"
Another honk.
"Car three?"
Another sharp honk from the driver of Lloyd Adams's car. Cavalli stared in through the window as the bald actor removed the top of his wig box.
"Car four?"
Not a sound came from car four.
"Is everyone in car four who should be in car four?"
barked the director. It was then that Cavalli remembered what had been nagging at him. He still hadn't seen Angelo or Dollar Bill all morning. He should have checked earlier. He hurried towards the director as a naval lieutenant jumped out of a car which he'd left stranded in the middle of the road. He was 6 feet tall, with short cropped hair, wearing a white uniform with a sword swinging by his side and medals for service in Panama and the Gulf on his chest. In his right hand he carried a black box. A policeman began chasing after him while Dollar Bill, carrying a small leather bag, followed a few yards behind at a slower pace. When Cavalli saw what had happened, he changed direction and walked calmly out into the middle of the road, and the naval officer came to a halt by his side. What the hell do you think you're playing at? Barked Cavalli.
We got held up in the traffic, said Angelo lamely. If this whole operation fails because of you...
Angelo turned the color of his uniform as he thought about what had happened to Bruno Morelli.
And the sword? Snapped Cavalli. A perfect fit. And our physician, is he fit?
He'll be able to do his job, I promise you, Angelo said, looking over his shoulder.
Which car are you both in?
Number 4, directly behind the president.
Then get in, and right now. Sorry, sorry,
Dollar Bill said as he arrived, panting.
My fault, not Angelo's. Sorry, sorry,
he repeated as the back door of car 4 was held open for him by the lieutenant, who was gripping his sword. Once Dollar Bill was safely in, Angelo joined the would-be physician and slammed the door behind him. The policeman who'd been chasing Angelo took his notebook out as Cavalli turned around looking for Tom Newbolt. Tom was already running across the road.
Leave him to me, was all he said.
The second van with surveillance cameras on board screeched to a halt to complete the line. The front window purred down.
Sorry, boss, said the driver. Some jerk just dumped his car right in front of me.
The clock on the old post office tower struck 10. At that moment, on a signal from the coordinating officer, several policemen walked out into the road. Some held up the traffic coming down Pennsylvania Avenue, while others placed diversion signs to direct the cars away from where the filming was taking place. Cavalli turned his attention to the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, a mere 700 yards away. It was still bumper to bumper with slow-moving traffic.
Come on, come on, he shouted out loud as he checked his watch and waited impatiently for the all clear.
Any moment now, shouted back the officer, who was standing in the middle of the road. Cavalli looked up to see the blue and white police helicopter hovering noisily overhead. Neither he nor the officer spoke again until a couple of minutes later when they heard a sharp whistle blow 3 times from the far end of Pennsylvania Avenue. Cavalli checked his watch. They'd lost 6 precious minutes.
I'll kill Angelo, he said. If...
All clear, shouted the coordinating officer. He turned to face Cavalli, who gave the director a thumbs-up sign.
You've still got 39 minutes, bellowed the officer. That should easily be enough time to complete the shoot twice.
But Cavalli didn't hear the last few words as he ran to the car, pulled open the door, and jumped into the seat next to the driver. And then a nagging thought hit him. Looking out the side window, Cavalli began to scan the crowd once again.
Lights! Screamed the director, and Pennsylvania Avenue lit up like Christmas Eve at Macy's. Okay, everybody, we're going to shoot in 60 seconds.
The limousines and motorcycles switched on their engines and began revving up. The extras strolled up and down while the police continued to divert the commuters away from the scene. The director leaned back over his chair to check the lights and see if the 7th in line was working.
30 seconds.
Johnny looked at the driver of the first car and said through the megaphone,
Don't forget to take it easy. My tracking dolly can only manage 10 miles an hour going backwards.
And walkers, the director checked up and down the sidewalk.
Please, look as if you're walking, not auditioning for Hamlet.
The director turned his attention to the crowd.
Now, don't let me down behind the barriers. Clap, cheer, and wave, and please remember we're going to do the whole exercise again in about 20 minutes, so stick around if you possibly can.
15 seconds, said the director, as he swung back to face the first car in line.
Good luck, everybody.
Tony stared at Scaziatore, willing him to get on with it. They were now 8 minutes late, which, with this particular president, he had to admit, added an air of authenticity.
10 seconds. Rolling. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Action!
The woman pushing the laundry basket down the corridor ignored the Do Not Disturb sign on room 1137 and walked straight in. A rather overweight man, sweating profusely, was seated on the edge of the bed. He was jabbing out some numbers on the phone when he looked around and saw her.
Get out, you dumb bitch, he said and turned back to concentrate on redialing the numbers.
In 3 silent paces, she was behind him. He turned a second time, just as she leaned over, took the phone cord in both hands and pulled it around his neck. He raised an arm to protest as she flicked her wrists in 1 sharp movement. He slumped forward and fell off the bed onto the carpet,
just as the voice on the phone said, "Thank you for using AT&T. She realized that she shouldn't have used the phone cord. Most unprofessional. But nobody called her a dumb bitch. She replaced the phone on the hook and bent down, deftly hoisting the special assistant to the president onto her shoulder. She dropped him into the laundry basket. No one would have believed such a frail woman could have lifted such a heavy weight. In truth, the only use she had ever made of a major in physics was to apply the principles of fulcrums, pivots, and levers to her chosen profession. She opened the door and checked the passageway. At this hour, it was unlikely there'd be many people around. She wheeled the basket down the corridor until she reached the housekeeper's elevator, faced the wall, and waited patiently. When the elevator arrived, she pressed the button that would take her to the garage. When the elevator came to a halt on the lower ground floor, she wheeled the basket out and over to the back of a Honda Accord, the second most popular car in the United States. Shielded by a pillar, she quickly transferred the special assistant from the basket into the trunk of the car. She then wheeled the basket back to the elevator, took off her baggy black uniform, dropped it into the laundry basket, removed her carrier bag with the long cord handle, and dispatched the laundry basket to the 25th floor. She straightened up her Laura Ashley dress before climbing into the car and placing her carrier bag under the front seat. She drove out of the parking lot onto F Street and had only traveled a short distance before she was stopped by a traffic cop. She rolled the window down. "Follow the diversion sign," he said, without even looking at her. She glanced at the clock on her dashboard. It was 10:07. Chapter 14. As the lead police car moved slowly away from the curb, the director's tracking dolly began running backwards at the same pace along its track. The crowds behind the barrier started to cheer and wave. If they'd been making a real film, the director would have called cut after 20 seconds because that fool of a coordinating officer was still standing in the middle of the road, hands on hips, oblivious to the fact that he wasn't the star of the film. Cavalli didn't notice the officer as he concentrated on the road ahead of him. He phoned through to Andy, who he knew would still be seated on the bench on 7th Street reading the Washington Post. "Not much action this end, boss. A little activity at the bottom of the ramp, but no one on the street is showing any real interest. Is everything all right your end? You're running late." "Yes, I know, but we should be with you in about 60 seconds, said Cavalli, as the director reached the end of his private railroad track and put one thumb in the air to indicate that the cars could now accelerate to 25 miles per hour. Johnny Scaziatore jumped off the dolly and walked slowly back down Pennsylvania Avenue so he could prepare himself for the second take. Cavalli flicked the phone off and took a deep intake of breath as the motorcade passed 9th Street. He stared at the FDR monument that was set back on a grass plot in front of the main entrance of the archives. The first car turned right on 7th Street. A mere half block remained before they would reach the driveway into the loading dock. The lead motorcycles sped up, and when they were opposite Andy standing on the sidewalk, they swung right and drove down the ramp. The rest of the motorcade formed a line directly opposite the delivery entrance, while the third limousine drove down the ramp, coming to a halt exactly opposite the loading dock. The counter-assault team were the first onto the street, and eight of them quickly formed a circle facing outward around the third car. After the eight men had stared in every direction for a few seconds, Cavalli jumped out of the second car, ran across to join them, and opened the back door of the third car so that Lloyd Adams could get out. Calder Marshall was waiting on the loading dock and walked forward to greet the president. "Nice to meet you, Mr. Marshall," said the actor, thrusting out his hand. "I've been looking forward to this occasion for some time." "As indeed have we, Mr. President. May I, on behalf of my staff, welcome you to the National Archives of the United States. Will you please follow me?" Lloyd Adams and his entourage dutifully followed Mr. Marshall straight into the Spartan freight elevator. As one of the Secret Service agents kept his finger on the open button, Cavalli gave the order for the motorcade to return to its starting point.
6 motorcycles and the 12 vehicles moved off and began the journey back to rejoin the director and prepare for the second shoot. The whole exercise of getting the actor into the building and the motorcade started on its return journey had taken less than 2 minutes. But Cavalli was dismayed to see that a small crowd had already gathered on the far side of the road by the Federal Trade Commission, obviously sensing something important was taking place. He only hoped Andy could deal with the problem. Cavalli quickly slipped into the elevator, wedging himself behind Adams. Marshall had already begun a short history of how the Declaration of Independence had ended up in the National Archives.
Most people know that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson drafted the Declaration that was approved by Congress on July 4, 1776. Few, however, know that the second and third presidents died on the same day, July 4, 1826, 50 years to the day after the official signing.
The elevator doors opened on the ground floor, and Marshall stepped out into a marble corridor and led them in the direction of his office.
The Declaration had a long and turbulent journey, Mr. President, before it ended up safely in this building.
When they reached the fifth door on the left, Marshall guided the President and his staff into his office, where coffee awaited them. Two of the Secret Service agents stepped inside while the other 6 remained in the corridor. Lloyd Adams sipped his coffee as Marshall ignored his in favor of continuing the history lesson.
After the signing ceremony on August 2, 1776, the Declaration was filed in Philadelphia, but because of the danger of the document being captured by the British, the engrossed parchment was taken to Baltimore in a covered wagon.
Fascinating, said Adams in a soft drawl. But had it been captured by the British infantry, copies would still have been in existence, no doubt.
Oh, certainly, Mr. President. Indeed, we have a good example of one in this building executed by William J. Stone. However, the original remained in Baltimore until 1777, when it was returned to the relative safety of Philadelphia.
In another wagon? Asked the President.
Indeed, said Marshall, not realizing his guest was joking. We even know the name of the man who drove it, a Mr. Samuel Smith.
Then in 1800, by direction of President Adams, the Declaration was moved to Washington, where it first found a home in the Treasury Department, but between 1800 and 1814, it was moved all over the city, eventually ending up in the old War Office building on 17th Street.
And, of course, we were still at war with Britain at that time, said the actor.
Cavalli admired the way Adams had not only learned his lines, but done his research so thoroughly.
That is correct, Mr. President, said the archivist. And when the British fleet appeared in Chesapeake Bay, the Secretary of State, James Monroe, ordered that the document be moved once again. Because, as I am sure you know, Mr. President, it is the Secretary of State who is responsible for the safety of the parchment, not the President.
Lloyd Adams did know, but wasn't sure if the President would have, so he decided to play safe.
Is that right, Mr. Marshall? Then perhaps it should be Warren Christopher who is here today to view the Declaration, and not me.
The Secretary of State was kind enough to visit us soon after he took office, Marshall replied.
But he didn't want the document moved again, said the actor.
Marshall, Cavalli, the lieutenant, and the physician dutifully laughed before the archivist continued.
Monroe, having spotted the British advancing on Washington, dispatched the Declaration on a journey up the Potomac to Leesburg, Virginia.
August 24th, said Adams, when they razed the White House to the ground.
Precisely, said Marshall. You are well informed, sir.
To be fair, said the actor, I've been well briefed by my special assistant, Rex Butterworth.
Marshall showed his recognition of the name, but Cavalli wondered if the actor was being just a little too clever.
That night, continued Marshall, while the White House was ablaze, thanks to Monroe's foresight, the Declaration was stored safely in Leesburg.
So when did they bring the parchment back to Washington? Asked Adams, who could have told the archivist the exact date.
Not for several weeks, sir. On September 17th, 1814, to be precise. With the exception of a trip to Philadelphia for the centennial celebrations, and its time in Fort Knox during World War II, the Declaration has remained in the capital ever since.
But not in this building, said Adams.
No, Mr. President, you're right again.
It had several other homes before ending up here, the worst being the patent office, where it hung opposite a window and was for years exposed to sunlight, causing the parchment irreparable damage. Bill O'Reilly stood in the corner, thinking how many hours of work he had had to do and how many copies he had had to destroy during the preparation stage because of that particular piece of stupidity. He cursed all those who had ever worked in the patent office.
"How long did it hang there?" asked Adams.
"For 35 years," said Marshall, with a sigh that showed he was every bit as annoyed as Dollar Bill that his predecessors had been so irresponsible. "In 1877, the declaration was moved to the State Department library. Not only was smoking common at the time, but there was also an open fireplace in the room. And I might add, the building was damaged by fire only months after the parchment had been moved."
"That was a close one," said Adams.
"After World War II was over," continued Marshall, "the declaration was taken from Fort Knox and brought back to Washington in a Pullman carriage before it was housed in the Library of Congress."
"I hope it wasn't exposed to the light once again," said Adams as Cavalli's phone rang.
Cavalli slipped into the corner and listened to the director tell him, "We're back on the starting line, ready to go whenever you are."
"I'll call when I need you," was all Cavalli said.
He switched his phone off and returned to listen to the archivist's disquisition. "In a thermopane case equipped with a filter to screen out damaging ultraviolet light."
"Fascinating. But when did the document finally reach this building?" asked Adams.
"On December 13th, 1952, it was transported from the Library of Congress to the National Archives in a tank under the armed escort of the U.S. Marine Corps."
"First a covered wagon and finally a tank," said the actor, who noticed that Cavalli kept glancing at his watch. "Perhaps the time has come for me to see the declaration in its full glory."
"Of course, Mr. President," said the archivist. Marshall led the way back into the corridor, followed by the actor and his entourage. "The declaration can normally be seen by the public in the rotunda on the ground floor, but we shall view it in the vault where it is stored at night."
When they reached the end of the corridor, the archivist led the president down a flight of stairs while Cavalli kept checking over the route that would allow them the swiftest exit if any trouble arose. He was delighted to find that the archivist had followed his instructions and kept the corridors clear of any staff. At the bottom of the steps, they came to a halt outside a vast steel door, at which an elderly man in a long white coat stood waiting. His eyes lit up when he saw the actor.
"This is Mr. Mendelssohn," said Marshall. "Mr. Mendelssohn is the senior conservator and, I confess, the real expert on anything to do with the parchment. He'll be your guide for the next few minutes before we visit the rest of the building."
The actor stepped forward and once again thrust out his hand.
"Good to meet you, Mr. Mendelssohn."
The elderly man bowed, shook the actor's hand, and pushed the steel door open.
"Please follow me, Mr. President," he said in a mid-European accent.
Once inside the tiny vault, Cavalli watched his men spread out in a small circle, their eyes checking everything except the president. Bill O'Reilly, Angelo, and Debbie also took their places as they had rehearsed the previous evening. Cavalli quickly glanced at Dollar Bill, who looked as if it was he who might be in need of a physician. Mendelssohn guided the actor towards a massive block of concrete that took up a large area of the far wall. He patted the slab of concrete and explained that the protective shell had been built at a time when the nation's greatest fear had been a nuclear attack. "The declaration is covered in 5 tons of interlocking leaves of metal, embedded in the 55-ton concrete steel vault you see before you. I can assure you, Mr. President," Mendelssohn added, "if Washington was razed to the ground, the Declaration of Independence would still be in one piece."
"Impressive," said Adams. "Most impressive."
Cavalli checked his watch. It was 10:24, and they'd already been inside the building for 17 minutes. Although the limousines were waiting, he had no choice but to allow the conservator to carry on at his own pace. After all, their hosts were aware of the limitations on the president's time if they were still hoping to show him around the rest of the building.
"The entire system, Mr. President," continued the conservator enthusiastically, "is worked electronically.
At the press of a button, the declaration, which is always exhibited and stored in an upright position, travels up from this level through interlocking doors, which open before the document finally comes to rest in a case of solid bronze, protected by ballistically tested glass and plastic laminate. Ultraviolet filters in the laminate give the inner layer a slightly greenish hue.
The actor looked lost, but Mr. Mendelssohn continued, quite unconcerned.
We are presently standing some 22 feet below the exhibit hall, and as the mechanics can be worked manually, I am able to stop the machinery at any time. With your permission, Mr. Marshall.
The archivist nodded, and the conservator touched a button that neither the actor nor Cavalli had spotted until that moment. The 5-ton leaves began to slide apart above their heads, and a sudden whirling and clanking sounded as the massive brass frame that housed the parchment began its daily journey towards the ceiling. When the frame had reached desk height, Mr. Mendelssohn pressed a second button, and the whirling sound instantly ceased. He then raised an open palm in the direction of the casing. Lloyd Adams took a step forward and stared across at the nation's most important historic document.
Now, remembering your personal wish, Mr. President, we in turn have a small request of you.
The actor seemed uncertain what his lines were meant to be and glanced towards Cavalli in the wings.
And what might that request be?
Prompted Cavalli, apprehensive of any change of plan at this late stage.
Simply, said Mr. Mendelssohn, that while the archivist and I are removing the outer casing of the declaration, your men will be kind enough to turn and face the wall.
Cavalli hesitated, aware that the Secret Service would never allow a situation to arise where they could not see the President at all times.
Let me make it easier for you, Mr. Mendelssohn, said Adams. I'll be the first to comply with your request.
The actor turned away from the document, and the rest of the team followed suit. In the brief space of time that the team was unable to see what was going on behind them, Cavalli heard 12 distinct clicks and the exaggerated sighs of two men not used to moving heavy weights.
Thank you, Mr. President, said Calder Marshall. I hope that didn't put you to too much inconvenience.
The 13 intruders turned around to face the massive frame. The bronze casing had been lifted over to leave the impression of an open book. Lloyd Adams, with Cavalli and Dollar Bill a pace behind, stepped forward to admire the original while Marshall and the conservator continued to stare at the old parchment. Suddenly, without warning, the actor reeled back, clutching his throat, and collapsed to the ground. 4 of the Secret Service agents immediately surrounded Adams, while the other 4 bundled the archivist and the conservator out of the vault and into the corridor before they could utter a word. Tony had to admit Johnny was right. It had been a bad case of overacting. Once the door was closed, Cavalli turned to see Dollar Bill already staring at the parchment, his eyes alight with excitement, the lieutenant by his side.
"Time for us to get to work, Angelo," said the Irishman.
He stretched his fingers out straight. The lieutenant removed a pair of thin rubber gloves from the doctor's bag and pulled them over his hands. Dollar Bill wiggled his fingers like a concert pianist about to begin a recital. Once the gloves were in place, Angelo bent down again and lifted a long, thin knife out of the bag, placing the handle firmly in Dollar Bill's right hand. While these preparations were being carried out, Dollar Bill's eyes had never once left the document. Those who remained in the room were so silent that it felt like a tomb as the forger leaned over towards the parchment and placed the blade of the knife gently under the top right-hand corner. It peeled slowly back, and he transferred the knife to the left-hand corner, and that too came cleanly away. Dollar Bill passed the knife back to Angelo before he began rolling the parchment up slowly and as tightly as he could without harming it. At the same time, Angelo flicked back the handle of his dress sword and held the long shaft out in front of him. Cavalli took a step forward and slowly pulled out Dollar Bill's counterfeit copy from the specially constructed chamber where the sword's blade would normally have lodged. Cavalli and Dollar Bill exchanged their prizes and reversed the process. While Cavalli slid the original declaration inch by inch down the scabbard of the dress sword, Dollar Bill began to unroll his fake carefully onto the back plate of the laminated glass, the moist chemical mixture helping the document to remain in place. The counterfeiter sniffed loudly. The strong smell suggested thymol to his sensitive nose. Dollar Bill gave his copy one more long look, checked the spelling correction, and then took a step backwards, reluctantly leaving his masterpiece to the tender care of the National Archives and its concrete prison. Once he had completed his task, Dollar Bill walked quickly over to the side of Lloyd Adams. Debbie had already undone his collar, loosened his tie, and applied a little pale foundation to his face. The forger bent down on one knee, took off the rubber gloves, and dropped them into a physician's bag full of makeup as Cavalli dialed a number on his cellular phone. It was answered even before he heard a ring, but Cavalli could only just make out a faint voice. "Take two," said Cavalli firmly, and rang off before pointing at the door. One of the Secret Service agents swung the steel grid wide open, and Cavalli watched carefully as Mr. Mendelssohn came charging through the gap and headed straight to the brass encasement, while Marshall, who was pale and quivering, went immediately to the side of the president. Cavalli was relieved to see a smile come across the lips of the conservator as he leaned over the fake declaration. With the help of Angelo, he pulled the brass casing across and gave the manuscript a loving stare before fixing the lid back into place, then quickly tightened the 12 locks around the outside of the casing. He pressed one of the buttons, and the whirling and clanking noise began again as the massive brass frame slowly disappeared back into the ground. Cavalli turned his attention to the actor and watched as two of the Secret Service agents helped him to his feet while Dollar Bill fastened his physician's bag.
"What chemical is it that protects the parchment?" asked Dollar Bill.
"Thymol," replied the archivist. "Of course, I should have guessed. With the president's allergy problem, I might have expected this reaction. Don't panic. As long as we get him out in the fresh air as quickly as possible, he'll be back to normal in no time."
"Thank God for that," said Marshall, who hadn't stopped shaking.
"Amen," said the little Irishman as the actor was helped towards the door.
Marshall quickly rushed to the front and led them back up the stairs, with the Secret Service agents following as close behind as possible. Cavalli left Lloyd Adams, stumbling behind him while he caught up with the archivist.
"No one, I repeat, no one must hear about this incident," he said, running by Marshall's side. "Nothing could be more damaging to the president when he has only been in office for such a short time, especially remembering what Mr. Bush went through after his trip to Japan." "After his trip to Japan, of course, of course."
"If any of your staff should ask why the president didn't complete his tour of the building, stick to the line that he was called back to the White House on urgent business."
"Called back on urgent business, of course," said Marshall, who was now whiter than the actor.
Cavalli was relieved to find his earlier orders about no staff being allowed in the lower corridor while the president was in the building still remained in force. Once they had reached the freight elevator and all the group was inside, they descended to the level of the loading dock. Once the doors opened, Cavalli sprinted ahead of them, up the ramp and onto 7th Street. He was annoyed to find that there was still a small crowd on the far sidewalk and no sign of the motorcade. He looked anxiously to his right, where Andy was now standing on the bench, pointing towards Pennsylvania Avenue. Cavalli turned to look in the same direction and saw the first motorcycle escort turning right into 7th Street. He ran back down the ramp to find Lloyd Adams next to a Federal Express pickup box being propped up by two Secret Service agents.
"Let's make it snappy," said Cavalli. "There's a small crowd out there and they're beginning to wonder what's going on."
He turned to face the archivist who was standing next to the conservator on the loading dock.
"Please remember, the president was called back to the White House on urgent business."
They both nodded vigorously as four of the Secret Service agents rushed forward just as the third car, engine running, pulled up to the loading dock at the bottom of the ramp. Cavalli opened the door of the third limousine and frantically waved the actor in. The lead riders on the motorcycles held up the traffic as the final car came to a halt at the mouth of the delivery entrance. As Lloyd Adams was assisted into the limousine, the small crowd on the other side of the road began pointing and clapping. One of the Secret Service agents nodded back in the direction of the building. Angelo ran forward and jumped into the second car, still clinging to the sword, while Dollar Bill and the secretary piled into the fourth. By the time Cavalli had joined Angelo in the back of the second car and given the signal to move, the motorcycle escort was already in the middle of 7th Street, holding up the traffic to allow the motorcade to proceed towards Constitution Avenue. As the sirens blared and the limousines began their journey down 7th Street, Cavalli looked back and was relieved to see there was no longer any sign of Marshall or Mendelssohn. He quickly switched his attention to the east side of 7th Street, where Andy was explaining to the crowd that it had not been the president, but simply a rehearsal for a movie, nothing more.
Most of the onlookers showed their obvious disappointment and quickly began to disperse. Then he thought he saw him again. As Cavalli's car sped down Constitution Avenue, the lead police car was already turning right into 14th Street, accompanied by two of the outriders. The sirens had been turned off, and the rest of the motorcade peeled off one by one as they reached their allotted intersections. The first car swung right on 9th Street and right again back onto Pennsylvania Avenue before heading away in the direction of the Capitol. The third continued on down Constitution Avenue, keeping to the center lane, while the fourth turned left onto 12th Street and the sixth right at 13th. The fifth turned left on 23rd Street, crossing Memorial Bridge and following the signs to Old Town, while the second car turned left at 14th Street and headed towards the Jefferson Memorial and onto the George Washington Memorial Parkway. Cavalli, who was seated in the back of the second car, dialed the director. When Johnny answered the phone, the only words he heard were, "It's a wrap." Chapter 15. Scott prayed that the ambassador's wife would be unable to get away on Thursday, or might still be in Geneva. He remembered Dexter Hutchins saying, "Patience is not a virtue when you work for the CIA. It's nine-tenths of the job." When he stopped at the end of the pool, Hannah told him that the ambassador's wife hadn't returned from Switzerland. They didn't bother to swim another length and agreed to meet later at the amusement park in the Bois de Vincennes. The moment he saw her walking across the road, he wanted to touch her. There were no instructions in any of the CIA handbooks on how to deal with such a situation, and no agent had ever raised the problem with him during the past 9 years. Hannah briefed him on everything that was happening at the embassy, including something big taking place in Geneva that she didn't yet know the details of. Scott told her in reply to her question that he had reported back to Kratz and that it wouldn't be long before she was taken out. She seemed pleased. Once they began to talk of other things, Scott's training warned him that he ought to insist she return to the embassy. But this time he left Hannah to make the decision as to when she should leave. She seemed to relax for the first time and even laughed at Scott's stories about the macho Parisians he met up with in the gym every evening. As they strolled around the amusement park, Scott discovered it was Hannah who won the teddy bears at the shooting gallery and didn't feel sick on the Big Dipper. "Why are you buying cotton candy?" he asked. "Because then no one will think we're agents," she replied. "They'll assume we're lovers." When they parted 2 hours later, he kissed her on the cheek. Two professionals behaving like amateurs. He apologized. She laughed and disappeared. Shortly after 10 o'clock, Hamid al-Obeidi joined a small crowd that had formed on the sidewalk opposite a back entrance of the National Archives. He had to wait some 20 minutes before the door opened again, and Cavalli came running up the ramp just as the motorcade reappeared on the corner of 7th Street. Cavalli gave a signal, and they all came rushing out to the waiting cars. Al-Obeidi couldn't believe his eyes. The deception completely fooled the small crowd, who began waving and cheering. As the first car disappeared around the corner, a man who had been there all the time explained that it was not the president, but simply the rehearsal for a film. Al-Obeidi smiled at this double deception while the disappointed crowd drifted away. He crossed 7th Street and joined a long line of tourists, schoolchildren, and the simply curious who had formed a line to see the Declaration of Independence. The 39 steps of the National Archives took as many minutes to ascend, and by the time the deputy ambassador entered the rotunda, the river of people had thinned to a tributary which flowed on across the marble hall to a single line up a further 9 steps, ending in a trickle under the gaze of Thomas Jefferson and John Hancock. Before him stood the massive brass frame that housed the Declaration of Independence. Al-Obeidi noted that when a person reached the parchment, he was only able to spend a few moments gazing at the historic document. As his foot touched the first of the steps, his heart started beating faster, but for a different reason from everyone else waiting in the line.
He removed from his inside pocket a pair of spectacles whose glass could magnify the smallest writing by a degree of 4. The deputy ambassador walked across to the center of the top step and stared at the Declaration of Independence. His immediate reaction was one of horror. The document was so perfect it must surely be the original. Cavalli had fooled him. Worse, he had succeeded in stealing $10 million by a clever deception. Al-Obeidi checked that the guards on each side of the encasement were showing no particular interest in him before putting on the spectacles. He leaned over so that his nose was only an inch from the glass as he searched for the one word that had to be spelled correctly if they expected to be paid another cent. His eyes widened in disbelief when he came to the sentence, "Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren." The ambassador's wife returned from Geneva with her husband the following Friday. Hannah and Scott had managed to steal a few hours together that morning. It had been less than 3 weeks since he had first seen her in the public baths in the Boulevard Lannes, just over a week since that first hastily arranged meeting at the little café on the Avenue Bugeaud. That was when the lies had begun. Little ones, to start with, that grew larger until they had spun themselves into an intricate web of deceit. Now Scott longed to tell her the truth. But as each day passed, it became more and more impossible. Langley had been delighted with the coded messages, and Dexter had congratulated him on doing such a first-class job. "As good a junior field officer as I can remember," Dexter admitted. But Scott had discovered no code to let the deputy director know he was falling in love. He had read Hannah's file from cover to cover, but it gave no clue as to her real character. The way she laughed, a smile that could make you smile, however sad or angry you were. A mind that was always fascinating and fascinated by what was happening around her. But most of all, a warmth and gentleness that made their time apart seem like an eternity. And whenever he was with her, he was suddenly no more mature than his students. Their clandestine meetings had rarely been for more than an hour, perhaps two, but it made each occasion all the more intense. She continued to tell him everything about herself with a frankness and honesty that belied his deceit, while he told her nothing but a string of lies about being a Mossad agent whose front, while he was stationed in Paris, was writing a book, a travel book, which would never be published. That was the trouble with lies. Each one created the next in a never-ending spiral. And that was the trouble with trust. She believed his every word. When he returned home that evening, he made a decision he knew Langley would not approve of. As the car edged its way into the left lane of the George Washington Memorial Parkway, bound for the airport, the driver checked the rear-view mirror and confirmed no one was following them. Cavalli breathed a deep sigh of relief, though he had 2 alternative plans worked out if they were caught with the declaration. He'd realized early on that it would be necessary to get as far away from the scene of the crime as quickly as possible. It had always been a crucial part of the plan that he would hand over the document to Nick Vicente within 2 hours of its leaving the National Archives. "So let's get on with it," said Cavalli, turning his attention to Angelo, who was seated opposite him. Angelo unbuckled the sword that hung from the belt around his waist. The 2 men then faced each other like Japanese sumo wrestlers, each waiting for the other to make the first move. Angelo placed the sword firmly between his legs, the handle pointing towards his boss. Cavalli leaned over and snapped the top back. Then, with the nail of his right thumb and forefinger, he extracted the thin black cylinder from its casing. Angelo pressed the handle back in place and hitched the sword onto his belt. Cavalli held the 26-inch long, slim plastic cylinder in his hands.
"It must be tempting to have a look," said Angelo.
"There are more important things to do at the moment," said Cavalli, placing the cylinder on the seat next to him. He picked up the car phone, pressed a single digit followed by send, and then waited for a response.
"Yes," said a recognizable voice.
"I'm on my way, and I'll have something to declare when I arrive." There was a long silence, and Cavalli wondered if he had lost the connection.
"You've done well," came back the eventual reply. "But are you running on schedule?"
Cavalli looked out of the window. The exit sign for Route 395 South flashed past. I'd say we're about a couple of minutes from the airport. As long as we make our allocated time slot, I still hope to be with you around 1 o'clock.
Good, then I'll have Nick join us so that the contract can be picked up and sent on to our client. We'll expect you around 1.
Cavalli replaced the phone and was amused to find Angela was dressed only in a vest and underpants. He smiled and was about to comment when the phone rang. Cavalli picked it up. Yes, he said.
It's Andy. I thought you'd like to know it's back on display to the general public and the lines are as long as ever. By the way, an Arab stood around in the crowd the whole time you were in the building and then joined the line to see the declaration.
Well done, Andy. Get yourself back to New York. You can fill me in on the details tomorrow. Cavalli put the phone down and considered Andy's new piece of information as Angela was completing a Windsor knot on a tie no lieutenant would have been seen dead in. He still didn't have his trousers on. The smoked glass between the driver and the passengers slid down.
We're just coming up to the terminal, sir. No one has followed us at any point.
Good, said Cavalli, as Angelo hurriedly pulled on his trousers.
Once you've changed your license plates, drive back to New York.
The driver nodded as the limousine came to a halt outside Signature Flight Support. Cavalli grabbed the plastic tube, jumped out of the car, ran through the terminal, and out onto the tarmac. His eyes searched for the white Learjet. When he spotted it, a door opened and the steps were lowered to the ground. Cavalli ran towards them as Angelo followed him, trying to pull on his jacket in the high wind. The captain was waiting for them on the top step.
You've just made it in time for us to keep our slot, he told them.
Cavalli smiled, and once they had both clicked on their seatbelts, the captain pressed a button to allow the steps to swing back into place. The plane lifted off 17 minutes later, banking over the Kennedy Center, but not before the steward had served them each a glass of champagne. Cavalli rejected the offer of a second glass as he concentrated on what still needed to be done before he could consider his role in the operation completed. His thoughts turned once again to Al-Obeidi, and he began to wonder if he'd underestimated him. When the Learjet landed at LaGuardia 57 minutes later, Cavalli's driver was waiting by his car, ready to whisk them into the city. As the driver continually switched lanes and changed direction on the highway that would eventually take them west over the Triborough Bridge, Cavalli checked his watch. They were now lost in a sea of traffic heading into Manhattan, only 87 minutes after leaving Calder Marshall outside the delivery entrance of the National Archives. Roughly, the time it would take a Wall Street banker to have lunch, Cavalli thought. Cavalli was dropped outside his father's 75th Street brownstone just before 1, leaving Angelo to go on to the Wall Street office and monitor the checking-in calls as each member of the team filed his report. The butler held open the front door of number 23 as Tony stepped out of the car.
"Can I take that for you, sir?" he asked, eyeing the plastic tube.
"No, thank you, Martin," said Tony. "I'll hold on to it for the moment. Where's my father?"
"He's in the boardroom with Mr. Vicente, who arrived a few minutes ago."
Tony jogged down the staircase that led to the basement and continued across the corridor. He strode into the boardroom to find his father sitting at the head of the table, deep in conversation with Nick Vicente. The chairman stood up to greet his son, and Tony passed him the plastic tube.
"Hail, conquering hero," were his father's first words. "If you'd pulled off the same trick for George III, he would have made you a knight. Arise, Sir Antonio. But as it is, you'll have to be satisfied with $100 million compensation. Is it permissible for an old man to see the original before Nick whisks it away?"
Cavalli laughed and removed the cap from the top of the cylinder before slowly extracting the parchment and placing it gently on the boardroom table. He then unrolled 200 years of history. The three men stared down at the Declaration of Independence and quickly checked the spelling of British.
"Magnificent," was all Tony's father said as he began licking his lips. "Interesting how the names on the bottom were left with so little space for their signatures," observed Nick Vicente after he had studied the document for several minutes. "If they'd all signed their names the same size as John Hancock, we would have needed a declaration of twice the length," added the chairman as the phone on the boardroom table started to ring. The chairman flicked a button on his intercom.
"Yes, Martin.
There's a Mr. Al-Obeidi on the private line. Says he would like to have a word with Mr. Tony.
Thank you, Martin, said the chairman, as Tony leaned over to pick up the call. Why don't you take it in my office, then I can listen in on the extension.
Tony nodded and left the room to go next door, where he picked up the receiver on his father's desk. Antonio Cavalli, he said.
Hamid Al-Obeidi here. Your father suggested I call back around this time.
We are in possession of the document you require, was all Cavalli said.
I congratulate you, Mr. Cavalli.
Are you ready to complete the payment as agreed?
All in good time, but not until you have delivered the document to the place of our choosing, Mr. Cavalli, as I'm sure you will recall was also part of the bargain.
And where might that be? Asked Cavalli.
I shall come to your office at 12 o'clock tomorrow, when you will receive your instructions, he paused. Among other things.
The line went dead. Cavalli put the phone down and tried to think what Al-Obeidi could possibly mean by among other things. He walked slowly back to the boardroom to find his father and Nick poring over the declaration. Tony noticed that the parchment had been turned around. What do you think he meant by among other things? Tony asked.
I have no idea,
replied his father, as he gave the parchment one last look and then began slowly to roll it up. No doubt I'll find out tomorrow, said Tony, as the chairman handed the document to his son, who carefully slipped it back into its plastic container.
So where's its final destination to be? Asked Nick.
I'll be given the details at 12 o'clock tomorrow, said Tony, a little surprised that his father hadn't reported the phone conversation with Al-Obeidi to his oldest friend. Chapter 16. He lay watching her, his head propped up in the palm of his hand, as the first sunlight of the morning crept into the room. She stirred, but didn't wake as Scott began to run a solitary finger down her spine. He couldn't wait for her to open her eyes and revive his memories of the previous night. When Scott had, in those early days, watched Hannah walking from the Jordanian embassy, dressed in those drab clothes so obviously selected with Karima Saib's tastes in mind, he thought she still looked stunning. Some packages, when you remove the brightly colored wrapping, fail to live up to expectation. When Hannah had first taken off the dowdy little two-piece suit she had been wearing that day, he had stood there in disbelief that anyone could be so beautiful. He pulled back the single sheet that covered her and admired the sight that had taken his breath away the night before. Her short cropped hair. He wondered how the long flowing strands would look when they fell on her shoulders as she wanted them to. The nape of her neck, the smooth olive skin of her back, and the long, shapely legs. His hands were like a child's that had opened a stocking full of presents and wanted to touch everything at once. He ran his fingers down her shoulders to the arch of her back, hoping she would turn over. He moved a little closer, leaned across, and began to circle her firm breasts with a single finger. The circles became smaller and smaller until he reached her soft nipple. He heard her sigh, and this time she did turn and fall into his arms, her fingers clinging to his shoulders as he pulled her closer.
"It's not fair. You're taking advantage of me," she said drowsily as his hand moved up the inside of her thigh.
"I'm sorry," he said, removing his hand and kissing her cheek.
"Don't be sorry. For heaven's sake, Simon, I want you to take advantage of me," she said, pulling his body closer to her.
He continued to stroke her skin all the time, discovering new treasures. When he entered her, she sighed a different sigh, the sigh of morning love, calmer and more gentle than the demands of the night, but every bit as enjoyable. For Scott, it had been a new experience. Although he had made love many more times than he cared to remember, it had never been with the same excitement.